The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and I want to thank you for joining me tonight. My first guest will be Lila Jana, the founder and CEO of Samasource. Their mission is to reduce global poverty by outsourcing digital work to unemployed people in impoverished countries. And the nature of this work is quite interesting.
The work that they do is in this really interesting space of training data. So in order to automate a process like driving a car or recognizing a face, you need to teach the machine how to recognize patterns. And our workers are trained to annotate images and videos as part of that training data process.
And it's been a while since we've had a workplace culture segment for you. So today, we'll be going to visit the offices of Ideas 42. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, March 17th. An unconditional cash transfer program in Kenya found that when people in a relationship, especially women, received extra money, rates of physical and sexual violence declined. The number of suicides and alcohol and drug-induced fatalities in the United States reached a record high of 152,000 in 2017. The total included 36,000 alcohol deaths, 74,000 drug deaths, and 47,000 suicide deaths. Since 1910, global HIV and AIDS infection rates have fallen by 16% in adults and by 35% for children. Most countries are now on track to eliminate infections by 2030. Nepal became the 54th country in the world and the first country in South Asia to pass a law banning corporal punishment for children. Honduras had the highest homicide rate in the world in 2012. Murders have decreased by half since then, more than any other nation. Women fundraisers make nearly 11% less than men in that job. And finally, the MacArthur Foundation wants to call attention to the need for financing that doesn't seek market rate returns to help impact investing grow and achieve its potential. To that end, it has created the Catalytic Capital Consortium and committed $150 million to patient financing. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Lila Jana of Samasource right after this.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change when she found Year Up. Like many in her community, she was smart and talented, but didn't have the same opportunities as others. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and experience, entering the healthcare IT field upon graduation. Year Up is a transformative opportunity for motivated young adults and companies looking for talent. 85% of alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
For decades now, the preferred method to lift people up and out of global poverty has been international aid. But more and more people have come to realize that it is not only ineffective, it actually is counterproductive. Direct cash transfers has had some success, but they too pale when compared to providing someone with a job at a living wage. No organization has been able to do that more creatively and energetically than has Samasource. And it's a great pleasure to have with us this evening their founder and CEO, Lila Jana. Good evening, Lila, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me, Denver.
Tell us about the mission of Samasource, what the organization was created to do, and what the meaning of Sama is.
Sure. Sama means equal in Sanskrit, and Samasource fuels AI for humanity. So we have a really interesting business model that involves recruiting and training people from very low-income backgrounds, primarily in East Africa, and actually a majority of whom are women, to do work in the AI supply chain for large companies and, in some cases, tech startups. The work that they do is in this really interesting space of training data. So in order to automate a process like driving a car or recognizing a face, you need to teach the machine how to recognize patterns. And our workers are trained to annotate images and videos as part of that training data process. We have now created living wage jobs for over 10,000 workers
Wow.
in Kenya and Uganda. And what's exciting is when we say living wage, not only are we paying living wages, but we're also recruiting people who came from very poor backgrounds. On average, we improve people's incomes by over 500%. And we now have over 2,000 people working full-time for SamaSource from our offices in Nairobi in Kenya, Kampala in Uganda, and even a rural community in northern Uganda in the town of Gulu.
And what's particularly cool about that is that even after they leave Sama, about 95% of them maintain that living wage.
It's really hard to do. I studied development economics because I was really passionate about addressing this problem of poverty, but I felt like so many of the aid models I'd seen were at best paternalistic and at worst straight up colonial. And they really, you know, it really reminded me of what my parents who grew up in India told me that, you know, they heard growing up, which is that there was this mentality on the part of the British colonialists that Indians were lazy and kind of not going to amount to anything without colonialism. And that's still something that they heard growing up in the 60s and 70s. And my father said, well, now look back. And very famously, Bill Gates has said there would be no Microsoft if it were not for the India Institute of Technology. So similarly, there is so much talent in sub-Saharan Africa that really gets overlooked with the traditional aid model that views people as these passive recipients of aid as opposed to producers.
You know, let's talk a little bit about global poverty, because I know you have, as you just said, studied that a lot. And you believe that a whole myriad of social problems can really trace their root back to global poverty. What have you observed that has led you to that conclusion?
I have spent a lot of time living in poor communities and working in developing regions. And what frustrates me is we're so often attacking the symptoms and not the root causes of a problem. There are essentially two root causes for, I'd say, like over 90% of the problems we face in the world. They are climate change, right? And a lot of the things that we're doing as humans that are contributing to that, and extreme poverty. If we address those two root problems, we can solve so many of the downstream effects of those problems. Problems like in my field, maternal mortality.
Mm-hmm.
99% of the deaths that occur each year of women dying in childbirth or, you know, around that same time are due to poverty. 99%. That's from the World Health Organization.
Wow.
So we still have 300,000 women dying each year in childbirth, and almost all of those deaths are preventable. Right. And the way we prevent them is by increasing the incomes, the household incomes, especially when we can do that directly with those women. Right. So if you can ensure that a poor woman moves into a living wage job, you can solve not only, you know, her risk of dying in childbirth, but so many other risks that she faces. A lot of the health and education problems that we see are resulting from poverty. Even if you can provide free schooling in mm-hmm. a country like Kenya, the opportunity cost for many families of having their kids go to school instead of working in the field is just too high. Right. So you don't solve the problem necessarily by building a school or by donating books to a library. You solve the problem by increasing the income of those families. And it seems so obvious. It's like, oh, you want to solve poverty? We'll give people money. That seems obvious, right? But strangely, the aid world, because we've built up all of these large bureaucracies where people have incentives to do the opposite, you know, to not think about job creation, we have a really bifurcated model where business is seen as highly capitalist and profit maximizing, and all social good is supposed to happen in the nonprofit world or the, you know, through the aid model, which is, I think, fundamentally often denying people their humanity. So we have this very weird system, and I think most of the most exciting things that are happening in poverty reduction and in climate action are happening in the middle, in the field of social enterprise.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, I think in a lot of different fields, Lila, we need to redefine success. You know, I had somebody in here talking about the homeless problem that we have, and we look at success in the homeless arena is when the homeless shelters are 100% full. We're happy with the homeless shelters being 100% full. And it's like, no. That's not curing homeless. But that's that you get rewarded. You know, everybody's happy in City Hall. And it doesn't make any sense. And you could go down the list and have a whole bunch of those. Well, as you went along this journey, one of the first early pivotal moments for you is when you won a scholarship from a tobacco company, of all things, when you were 17 years old. And you went to Ghana. Tell us about that.
It was the most defining moment of my life, probably. Mm. I grew up hearing about India from my parents. My mom grew up in Calcutta, which is both India's intellectual capital and also one of its poorest major cities. And so this dichotomy between, you know, talent and, you know, having a population that's extraordinarily talented and also having very few job opportunities was apparent when I was a kid. But I never experienced it firsthand, right? I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles. My brother and I went to fantastic California public schools. Mm-hmm. We had every opportunity that so many young, you know, immigrants get when they come to America, which I'm so grateful for. But I had no idea what life was like living on $1 or $2 a day. And I got the chance to see that when I went to Ghana. So mostly this was fueled by a desire to have an adventure and leave home early. I was not having a good time at home with my parents. So I found a way to graduate from high school early. And I convinced this scholarship committee to let me use the money to go and do volunteer work in Africa. And I had this typical, you know, American savior mentality that I'd go to this sub-Saharan African country and teach these poor children English. And of course, I get there. And one of my kids was reading Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe, which is like a great work of literature. My students could name U.S. senators. Mm. They were listening to Voice of America and BBC Radio. And I immediately realized that I had internalized this myth, which is that poor people are helpless and yep. need saving. No one needs our saving. What people need is a level playing field to take advantage of the same opportunities that you or I would want. And so that became really evident when I was in Ghana. And I just became more and more frustrated because I saw so many organizations working to address poverty, but not fundamentally solving that core problem. If we simply increase the incomes of the parents, especially the mothers of the children in my school, none of them would be facing the challenges that I saw. I mean, I saw kids who were blind for entirely preventable reasons.
Yeah, it breaks your heart.
Breaks my heart, or kids who had cataracts but they couldn't afford the surgery. I mean, just things that in the year 2000 when I was there should not have happened and should definitely not be happening in 2019.
Yeah, there's a lot of wonderful international organizations that do great work, but there's also a lot that are writing their annual report and trying to say what they're going to say to their board and their constituents, and that is a driving force, not the people that they're supposedly trying to help. Well, you graduated from Harvard. And you went to work for a management consulting firm. But this little idea from Ghana was kicking around. So on the side, after hours and on weekends, you began to start to thinking about starting a social enterprise. So how did that evolve and grow to what then became SomaSource?
Well, bless my bosses at my consulting job because they were so accommodating of my crazy ideas when I was like a 22-year-old consultant. And actually, one of them said, you know, you should go out and pursue this. So I received support from the firm to write my first business plan for SomaSource. And then I ended up quitting months before I was to receive my second year bonus because I just couldn't wait to get something started.
Mm-hmm.
I had read Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat, yeah. Which was a big book that came out in around 2005. And I started connecting the dots between what I had observed in my consulting work. One of my clients was a large Indian outsourcing center that had a big workforce taking calls for companies like British Airways. And I had met somebody in that center who was commuting in from Dharavi, which is South Asia's largest slum where Slumdog Millionaire was filmed. And that, you know, light bulb went off of thinking, wow, here's somebody who wakes up in a slum in the morning in the same kind of slum where we're running all these NGO programs trying to help people get out of poverty. He hops on a rickshaw or on the train and shows up in this state-of-the-art call center and is literally taking calls for a woman, you know, from a woman in Leeds about her British Airways ticket. And I connected the dots and I thought, wow, this same model which Tom Friedman is describing, which is creating lots of jobs, but mostly for middle-income, educated people in big cities in places like India and the Philippines, that same model could be applied to address poverty very directly in a slum or in a rural area if we could somehow figure out a way to break down the work. And maybe there were simpler types of work to do than, you know, a customer service call, which would require certain language and customer service skills. So I started looking into that, and I had a friend, a Kenyan friend, who'd gone to college with me, and he organized a trip for a bunch of us to go and check out Kenya and go on a safari. So, of course, I'm, like, always thinking about social enterprise. So while we're on the safari, I'm thinking, I really want to go back to Nairobi and see if this concept might work in a city like Nairobi. Lo and behold, it did. Mm-hmm. So I had the idea. I met a couple of entrepreneurs in Nairobi who were running internet cafe businesses. So they had four or five computers with an internet line, and they would let people come in and pay to use those computers by the hour. None of them were really successful because the internet costs were high.
Yeah.
None of the young people could afford a dollar an hour to use the internet. So I said, what if we repurpose these centers as micro work centers? What if I can find a contract with some firm? At the time I was living in San Francisco, some firm in Silicon Valley. And what if I could get the work done here in Kenya? My first client was a social enterprise called Benetech.
Mm.
And who you know.
I do. Been on the show a couple times.
Yep. Yeah. Jim Fruchterman, mm-hmm. the founder of Benetech, basically took
great
a chance
guy
on
and
me.
Great organization.
And I have to credit him. I would not be here. Our company would not be here had he not taken a chance, because everyone thought I was just Looney Tunes. I mean, I was going around Silicon Valley. I was pitching this concept on Sand Hill Road. Every VC turned me down and said, it's crazy enough you want to build this new business model that you want to do it in Africa and only hiring low-income people and paying them living wages. Why would we want to invest in that? So most people said it was a crazy idea. It wouldn't work. Most people on the foundation side said the same thing. They said, I kid you not, this is a direct quote. Somebody told me, poor women in Africa need mosquito nets before they can use computers. Mm. I mean, just this outdated mentality. I mean, anyone can use a computer, right?
Yeah.
And especially low-income people who are under pressure to access government services and to do their banking transactions. They don't have the luxury of getting in an Uber and going to a bank branch, right? They need to do it here and now. So I actually saw the opposite, that there was a much more ready technology adoption, especially mobile adoption in Africa. So that's how the business started, those humble beginnings. Over time, we started growing the types of work we could do. Originally, we started doing data entry. We moved up into image annotation and all this AI stuff. Now we are one of the leading training data providers in the world. We have ISO-certified facilities, biometric scanning. When you walk in, it really looks like a state-of-the-art technology center. And I think it's a real point of pride for East Africa to have this scale of an operation in Kenya.
Yeah. And I think it's referred to as impact sourcing. Would that be correct? I mean, we hear so much about impact investing, but not very much about impact sourcing, and it's really every bit as important.
Absolutely. We actually have been partners. We were, I think, the first grantee of the Rockefeller Foundation working in this category,
mm-hmm.
And that kind of inspired what has now become a movement around impact sourcing. There's now an impact sourcing standards body, and there's a bunch of us working together. So it's been really exciting to be a pioneer in that movement and collaborate on, you know, the language around it. I like to call it give work because
yeah.
it's quite simple.
Mm-hmm.
But the concept of impact sourcing is that rather than think at the corporate level, rather than think about achieving social impact through your foundation or your CSR program, you should think about achieving impact in the area where you have the most budget to tackle it, which is in procurement. So the biggest 2,000 companies in the world spend $12 trillion with a T
mm-hmm.
on goods and services, sourcing everything from, unfortunately, the lithium, which is often unethically mined, that's in our phones,
mm-hmm.
to the rugs in the conference rooms and everything in between. If we were to direct just 1% of that global sourcing dollar spend on vendors like Somasource that actively hire low-income people and pay them living wages and treat them well with basic, decent, good working standards, we could address poverty and so many of those downstream effects without actually spending more money.
Yeah.
Without having to set up big nonprofit bureaucracies to solve the problem, right? So again, it sounds so obvious, right? Why don't companies do this? Well, most of the time companies don't do it because there aren't often easy to find ethical suppliers in many categories, which is the single biggest opportunity for anyone listening to this who wants to be a social entrepreneur. Go build an ethical factory. Mm-hmm. I just talked to the head of social impact at Kate Spade this morning. They collaborated and they invested in a Rwandan-owned factory that manufactures tens of thousands of handbags in Rwanda. 93% of the employees are women. Mm-hmm. That is such a phenomenal give work model. Imagine if every brand did that. And imagine if we could take that Rwandan factory concept and scale it up much bigger. Yeah. Right. So that's where we can have the most dramatic impact. And I guarantee you, if you go and do a study on the long term impact of those wages paid to those women in Rwanda, or we've done lots of long term studies on our 2000 agents in Kenya and Uganda, you will see that that money has, instead of a trickle down effect, a trickle up effect. Because these people are then spending that money in poor communities. They're funding the local baker, the local shoemaker. They're building a more productive and prosperous economy from the ground up, but for low-income people.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, a lot of people think you're helping a woman or you're helping a family, but you're really helping the entire community. It just cascades and keeps on cascading.
Women reinvest 90% of their paychecks in the health and education of their own families and the community. So it's the single best investment, right. And it's better than any aid program that some scholar at Columbia or Harvard could ever design.
Yeah, I'm afraid to say men are about 40%.
We'll get you guys there.
First to 50, okay? You know, none of this would work, though, unless you were able to take all these workers and these huge projects of the companies that you just talked about, and somehow to break them down into something called micro work, which you do through Sama Hub. Tell us about that platform and how this all works.
Yeah, so it started with using off-the-shelf software. So I used to use a platform called Basecamp, and mm-hmm. I would personally manage these projects. I was personally doing like the QA on the work for Benetech, which was transcribing PDFs into text files. So we evolved from that into now handling massive data sets. For Microsoft, we have annotated millions and millions of images now. We were the primary training data provider for one of their big gaming devices. So that took obviously very different infrastructure. As soon as I could, I started hiring engineers. I think my first engineering hire was back in 2009. Mm-hmm. And we slowly built up what is now our core software platform called the Sama Hub. The Sama Hub allows us to pull data from a client's data sets into a system where we can then parse it out to different workers, and we can manage the workflow and manage the quality through our own platform. And over time, we're getting into a lot more automation of the work. For example, now when you're, say, annotating an image from a car camera, you might be seeing a picture of a road with lane lines and mm-hmm. vehicles on it. We can now auto-detect the edges of the cars in the image, for example. We're now handling 3D data. So some of the data that's used to develop the maps in your phones or to develop the sensors on your car that are telling you to stop when you need to stop or automatically stopping the car for you before you hit a pedestrian, those sensors are being trained with data from LiDAR systems, right? And LiDAR data looks like gobbledygook if you see it on a screen, but we've trained our agents to make sense of these images and to identify in a 3D rendering where a car might be in that rendering. So that's what the Sama Hub essentially allows us to do. It's basically allowing us to manage these highly complex scaled workflows across a large number of people in different time zones and different geographies, and then also to manage the QA. And where we really excel, now we've seen a lot of competition. There are crowdsourcing firms entering our space, but we pride ourselves on scale, on quality, and on security. Mm-hmm. A lot of the data we're seeing is not something that you would want someone annotating from an internet cafe or their bedroom somewhere. Yeah. You want to make sure that the data is secure, especially if you're handling, say, data for facial recognition algorithms that might come from user data, right? So you really have to treat that very sensitively. And we have our own facilities with a lot of infrastructure around them to support that. And I think that's the future, actually, of the training data industry. And mm-hmm. I think there are so many more jobs that could be created building training data to teach machines to do stuff. We're just at the beginning of this new economy.
You know, there are no jobs, of course, unless you have these corporate partners that you've been able to enlist. And we talked about Google and Microsoft, but there's eBay and LinkedIn and Walmart. Was it easier or harder than you thought to get them on board?
It took a while. When you work with a large enterprise, you have to be able to scale. And the challenge as a young startup is typically that the scale of these operations dwarfs anything you have, right? So you can easily get obliterated by a client request or fail really quickly, as has happened to me before with my other business with Luxme. But we started small and we grew. That's, I think, organic growth. It's not really encouraged in Silicon Valley, but I think it's the healthiest way to build a business, is not to pour too much gas on the fire before you have a there, and before you know you can handle it. And so we started small. I think our first pilot, after I talked to like 60 different people at Google, I finally got Google to give us a tiny pilot. That's grown into a relationship that's lasted now more than 5 years. The same with Microsoft. So we always start small with a pilot. We prove ourselves. We show that we know what we're doing. And then we often have very long-term relationships with our customers as a result.
You know, a lot of people think of Samosaurus as working strictly in the international community. But you also have programs here in the United States through something called Samus School. What is that about? How does that work?
I'm so happy you asked about this because I get accused all the time of just focusing on Africa and why don't I care about America? I care a lot about my own country and had been trying before even I started Samosaurus to think about ways to address domestic poverty. The problem that U.S. workers face is actually quite different than the problem that a lot of developing countries face, which is that here work has shifted into the gig economy in a really massive way. 90+% of job creation in the last decade has happened in the freelance or gig economy. Just think about that. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics just last year released the first ever report we've ever done on this sector. Meanwhile, like a third of Americans are freelancers now. I mean, it's really shocking. And so it was a battle for us to initially get Samosaurus started because we had this idea. After looking at the data, we said, could we start a version of Samosaurus here in the U.S.? And we looked at the data and we said, actually, it probably wouldn't be successful. What would be successful here is if we could figure out a way to equip low-income people with the skills to succeed in the gig economy, by which we mean to earn a living wage and to avoid getting scammed. Right. And we saw the potential that was in a lot of these crowdsourced type systems or these gig platforms. We saw the potential for low income people to benefit, but we also saw a lot of risks. So we said, let's be proactive. Let's try to find ways that we can help people navigate this new world as workers, especially people who've been long term unemployed, who are below the poverty line. We focus on demographics that really need the support. And we found after a quick pilot back in 2012, we found some amazing results. We found that if we just educate people on the basics of how the gig economy works, how to set up a profile on these different sites, how to choose a photo that looks professional, how to use the right keywords when you're marketing yourself. This is something that might not occur to you if you had a factory job for 20 years and all of a sudden became unemployed, right? Or if you were a truck driver for many years, and truck drivers are going to see a huge shift in their industry. We know that this is getting automated, right?
Yeah.
It's coming. And so we have a moral duty to make sure that people land on their feet. And one of the aspects of that is making sure our job training systems in this country are modernized. And it's currently an abomination. Mm-hmm. We're teaching people to do jobs that have gone away or are going away really rapidly, and we are not teaching them about the one sector that's growing the most, right? And I understand there's government skepticism. I don't think that to teach people about the gig economy means that you buy into everything that these platforms are doing. I think you can be a force for good and for positive change if you work with those platforms and if you design a training that's really targeting the needs of workers. So since we launched Sama School, which is a short boot camp, it's an 8 to 10 hour boot camp. We deliver it through local nonprofit partners, through the city workforce development programs in San Francisco and New York. We're actually rolling out with CUNY here in New York and with the California Community College system. And it's my hope, maybe someone listening works at the New York Public Library systems, but we could roll this out in every public space that has computers in this country. Imagine if your local library allowed you to access this training for free, and you could come in and learn in 8 to 10 hours how to quickly start earning money through the freelance economy, avoid the scams. There's lots of other skills you need, like how to manage your taxes as a freelancer, which are totally different than if you have have a traditional job, how to think about benefits. At the same time that we're doing this, we're also advocating for better treatment of freelance workers. We came out with a series of white papers last year. This will shock you, but did you know that anti-discrimination protections for workers do not apply to freelancers?
Yes, I do know that, as a matter of fact.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. There's a bunch of things like that that it's just unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. And most Americans, I would venture to guess that they don't know that, right?
No,
because
no.
You think like, oh, you're not allowed to tell someone they're not getting hired because they're gay or they're black. But you can absolutely do that with a freelancer, and
yeah,
it's legal.
Right.
So that seems like a very practical thing that we could solve that most people would agree is not okay, right? And these are the sorts of recommendations that we focus on. What are pragmatic solutions that most of us can agree on that we should adopt in this sector, that the companies that are creating these platforms, you know, should manage, and or maybe there's, you know, the potential for individuals to file suit if they're discriminated
against. Well, it's a brilliant niche that you have. You know, so many people don't have the mindset to be a freelancer, which is a big piece of it. You have to have a little bit of resilience and understand there's going to be the ups and downs. You're absolutely right about the soft skills. And I know a few people who've been working at a job for a long time and have been laid off or whatever. It's like they're going into a different world. They don't even know what they're looking for, monster.com or something. I mean, things that have been bygone. You know, we talked a little bit about before the inefficiencies and the frustrations about the nonprofit sector, so much so that you've become a self-sustainable organization. Talk a little bit more about that and where you see the shortcomings in the sector in terms of how we try to solve problems.
Well, you know, in the last few decades, as the wealth gap has grown in the United States, I think more and more people are now aware of this, with AOC and a lot of the young progressive members of Congress who are calling attention to this massive wealth inequality. But we live in a society that's as unequal as the U.S. was in the 1920s, in the age of robber barons, right? Which is absurd. When you have that big a wealth gap, you see these instances where basic services are reliant on donations from highly wealthy individuals to sustain themselves. And I think that shouldn't be the case, right? You can't rely on the whims of rich people to provide basic services. And I think that's the biggest problem with the traditional charity model, is basically things are donor driven. If you are accountable, you know, if your source of funding is coming from a wealthy individual, that person might change their mind after a couple of years,
sure,
right? They might move in a different direction. The nonprofit world has plenty of fads, just like any other industry. And I've seen firsthand in Africa the impact of that. If some rich person changes their mind, all of a sudden you might have thousands of people who can no longer access a critical service that they've come to depend on. And I think that whole system is deeply unhealthy. So we can resolve that in a few ways. You know, one is by reforming the tax system, which many people are doing, I think, and having important dialogues around. The other way is you can reform the nonprofit sector itself. And one of the things I try to encourage nonprofits to do is to think about building social enterprise models, give work models, right? There's no reason, if you're trying to fight poverty, that you shouldn't be thinking about jobs. You absolutely should be. There are so many more exciting opportunities for social entrepreneurship here in America. Think about everything from bakeries. I know several social enterprise bakeries, to restaurants. If I'm choosing where to go to dinner or where to take my fiance for date night, I would love the chance to choose a restaurant that also, you know, provides jobs to low-income
people. I go to Hot Bread Kitchen.
There you go. Is that here in New York?
Yeah, it is.
Wonderful.
Absolutely.
We have so many great examples. A friend of mine runs Old School Cafe, which is a soul food kitchen in the Bay Area that employs formerly incarcerated youth. She used to be a corrections officer. I mean, you get like so much more bang for your restaurant buck if you shop that way. This concept is really alive and well in many other countries. I think it's less developed in the U.S. because we don't have a lot of infrastructure around it. And there, frankly, are very few benefits for organizations that do this. Frankly, I think if you set up a social enterprise model that's directly giving work to a population that might otherwise have to receive government benefits, you should get a tax credit for doing that,
right?
Or maybe there should be some government wage subsidy for the people that you're transitioning into the workforce. So that happens in some cities at a city level, but it's nowhere near the national ambitious plan that it should be.
Yeah, and there's so many things in the sector that are siloed. And a perfect example of that would be foundations, where 5% of their money goes to grants and the other 95% can go to investments in petroleum or tobacco companies for all they care, as long as it gives a return. So you're beginning to finally see that. My concern a little bit about the rich giving a lot of money, which is a little bit different, is that it's really masking a big decline in the sector, because the number of people giving to charity are way down. And when this economy pops a little bit and goes down, these big gifts, which has made everybody feel somewhat complacent at $400 billion, it's going to be a tremendous hit on organizations. Exactly to your point, they become too dependent on those gifts. Well, I know you think the answer is somewhere in the middle, that it's not with nonprofits and it's not for business. It's right there in that sweet middle. And one of the organizations that you've started that's in that middle is Luxme. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is hopefully the last new company I'll start in a really long time, because it's impossible to...
Well, I have this on tape, by the way, okay?
...to divide my time. I know.
Staff know.
Believe me, many, many other stakeholders would agree. So I started Luxme because I was going back and forth to Uganda for Samasource, and I love when I go to Africa, when I go anywhere, I love shopping in local markets. Even here at the farmers market in New York City, it gives me so much joy to meet the creators of the products I'm buying, to hear their stories. I think everyone enjoys that kind of commerce more. So I always go to these local markets. And in northern Uganda, I came across in a local market this amazing skin cream called Nilotica. And I thought it was some local formula. But as I did more research, I learned that it was a single ingredient. It's a rare heirloom varietal of East African shea butter. And Nilotica is a different subspecies, but we're very basic about how we label plants. So unfortunately, most people think, oh, it's just it's shea butter. It's the same as any other shea butter. But just like all red wine comes from red grapes, you can have a $3,000 bottle of very fancy stuff, and you can have a bottle of $2 chuck, all made from red grapes, right? But there's a significant difference depending on how the grapes are grown, where they're grown, the whole process. And so I thought there was such an exciting opportunity to bring light to some of these amazing natural ingredients, which, by the way, are almost always, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, harvested by women, that could provide living wages to women doing the harvesting, and that could provide a powerful incentive to conserve the wildlife, to conserve the wilderness areas that these plants grow in, right? Right now, one of the biggest factors in climate change is that we're cutting down tropical rainforests at an incredible rate, right? And the reason we're doing that is that people need to eat and they need to live.
Right.
And the communities around those forests are often doing the cutting down because they need to graze cattle so that they can send their kids to school.
They need the land.
They need the land.
Arable land.
If you can show them that they can actually make more money by sustainably harvesting products from the forest, then you have a financial incentive to keep that land wild. And a lot of the biggest conservation organizations are now looking at these things called conservation incentives, which provide exactly that. Rather than work with a government to say, okay, you people living by this forest, you're not allowed to use the forest for anything, and we're going to make it a national park. Instead, is there a way that you can create a revenue stream for that population using sustainably resources from the forest? And the sustainably part is key, right? You obviously can't have a model where you're stealing everything from the forest and destroying the very plants that you need to keep alive for the model to continue. But there's some really exciting examples of this in production of many ingredients from South America, from the Amazon. There's amazing models with companies that are selling everything from teas to spices. So I thought that same model could work in skincare. And I said, let me see if I could get Nilotica on a luxury beauty counter alongside these skin creams, which I had previously been buying, that are full of toxic chemicals.
Petroleum and stuff.
Petroleum and stuff that is banned in other countries that's allowed in the U.S. because we haven't regulated this stuff in decades, because the people who are regulating it are paid by the industries that are producing it. So there's so much opportunity, I think, in this exciting new natural sector. Consumers want it. There's a hunger for plant-based remedies in food and health and wellness, and especially in skincare. And I thought there was a real opportunity to create a luxury brand around this concept. So I launched Luxme, which is derived from the goddess Lakshmi, the goddess of beauty and prosperity in Hindu culture. And Luxme stands for Beauty for Humanity. So we source rare botanicals in partnerships in partnership with local communities that have a fair trade model and an organic sourcing model. And we retail our products at really amazing partners like Sephora. Mm-hmm. And we also sell a lot now online on our website.
Very cool. Lila, there are very few organizations that score a 4 or above on Glassdoor. The ratings that are given by employees, but Samasource would be one of those. What makes your corporate culture so exceptional? Do you think about it a lot? And what are some of the things you do to shape it and influence it?
That's a great question. I wish I could say it was me and my brilliant ideas, but actually I think the reason our score is so high is that I've recognized where I'm really not great and hired people who are much better than me at managing people. I would say that as you grow as a company, it's really hard for founders to do this, but you have to recruit people who are excellent operators and managers who know how to manage large teams and scale them. And given that this was basically my second job out of college, mm-hmm. I didn't have that knowledge myself. So I'm really lucky. I have an amazing COO who I think has a very high EQ and understands how to navigate a bigger organization to get things done. And it's really in combination with people like her. We have an amazing management team that also is composed of seasoned managers who bring in with them a lot of strategies for keeping people happy and motivated. I think the one thing I could take some credit for is the underlying social mission in what we do. There's a lot of evidence that shows that people don't just show up to jobs for money. And those that do, and the kind of corporate cultures that are solely using financial incentives to reward people tend to be less exciting mm-hmm. and less motivating than those that have a shared mission. And I really believe that if you can align your values as a human being with the way you spend the majority of your time at work, you're just a happier person.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Because when things come up
in every aspect of your life.
Absolutely. When you have a fight about something, I know that when I'm fighting with someone on my management team, that person cares as much about the mission as I do, and that we're both fighting for something much bigger and much more noble than this issue on, you know, at hand. And I think when you have that underlying culture, you, in my view, have people who are happier and more independently motivated. They're not working for the man. They're not just working to make me or my COO richer. Mm-hmm. They're working for a much bigger concept, this concept of giving work. They know that it's not just our workers who are benefiting, but it's the entire community of people who are watching Samasource and realizing, wow, this can actually be done. When we started, people, as I mentioned, laughed us out of the room. Now we've shown that not only can this be done, not only can it be done in Africa, but it can be done in Africa with a population of people who nobody really believed could do AI training data before. Mm-hmm. And that concept is so powerful, knowing that we're a role model for other companies and illustrating that in this industry of that we're in that's increasingly being populated by crowdsourcing companies and companies that maybe don't have the same approach to labor standards as we do. It's exciting to feel like we're leading the good fight.
And you know what's also exciting is that when you look around and you see people who work there who actually care more about the organization than you do, or at least as much. I mean, that is the dream of every founder, that they have it that deep in their bones.
I really do, and I am grateful every second of every day that I have that, because it means the burden is shared. And I really feel like it's super hard in a startup to recruit people who you feel as a founder like own it more than you do. And we're now at that point with both Sama and Lexmi.
Well, when the burden gets a little too heavy, you turn to nature. Forest bathing, I think, as the Japanese would say. What does turning to the wilderness do for you?
You know, I read that a doctor in Scandinavia was starting to prescribe this to patients, and if only pharmaceutical industry incentives work that way in the U.S., that is exactly what we should be doing.
Yeah.
There's so much scientific evidence that shows that we are happier beings if we spend time in wilderness, not just a park, not a manicured garden, but real wilderness. And for me, having grown up right on the Pacific Ocean in Southern California, which I feel like is the promised land, for me, spending time in the ocean every week is critical. It's as critical to some people as, you know, eating or sleeping.
Yeah.
So I'm really lucky that I've had the chance to live by the ocean. I kite surf regularly, and mm-hmm. I'm just getting into surfing now. I actually went kite surfing here in Long Island at Gilgo Beach,
oh, cool.
which was awesome. But to me, that's that connection. It's using a kite, which is only wind-powered, and a board, and exploring different parts of the ocean and getting to see, you know, turtles and dolphins. And I've never seen a shark before, knock on wood, but it keeps me alive. And the other nice thing about more extreme sports is that if you're an entrepreneur who's constantly worrying about work and various issues coming up in the business, if you're not 100% focused when kiting on not dying or not getting dragged across the beach, that's going to happen to you. So you have to have that focus on the present moment, which is so hard to do as an entrepreneur. And really at no other time in my life, I can think of one other thing, but I won't mention that on the radio. Basically, very few times force you, or very few activities force you to be in the present. Mm-hmm. And so kiting does that for me.
Well, my life's a little less exciting, but golf does that for me. I can be thinking about something that's on my mind driving to the golf course and driving home, but I will never have one single thought other than trying to get the best score that I possibly can and give my friend some grief if I can as well during that time. Let me close with this, Lila. You know, the history and trajectory of Somasaurus kind of tells me there's always something around the next curve. Now, notwithstanding what you said, that no more ideas, no more new ventures, tell me what you're currently thinking about and what do you think is next for the organization in the next 5 years?
So I think there's going to be a huge opportunity in training data. I think this idea that machines are stealing all of our jobs is very short-sighted. Mm-hmm. And there's a tremendous number of jobs coming in fields like training machines to do things like training data, but also in totally non-automated fields like care. There's such a huge opportunity right now in high-quality elder care and child care in all over the world, right, where the population is booming. And it's going to be a long time before we have a machine or before we want a machine doing that kind of work. So I'm super excited about proposals like the Green New Deal mm-hmm. here in the U.S., which propose government incentives to employ people in potentially some of these areas. Imagine if we had government incentives for people to set up neighborhood childcare centers in their neighborhood. My neighborhood has one in San Francisco. There's a woman on our block who watches the kids in the neighborhood. As far as I know, it can be hard to get a childcare license. What if we had a program, right, that actually made it easier for people to set up these small types of businesses that are amazing jobs, right? It's beneficial for everyone in my block. It's beneficial for the kids to know each other. Imagine if we had those same types of incentives to steward wild lands. So we have an amazing national park system in this country. I think it is one of it's one of the things that makes me most patriotic about being an American is how much we've invested in preserving our wild lands. Imagine if we had more resources to do that at the community level. Mm-hmm. If you could start a community food garden, if you could be a steward of the land and other ways and actually earn money and have a job around that. And I don't think New Deal type policies need to be in existence forever. It's really designed for periods of great change when you need to retrain a large part of the population or rehabilitate a large part of the population, get them back on their feet and working. So I'm really excited about the ways in which both Sama School and Sama Source can be part of that dialogue. No one, as far as I know, has outlined what the Green New Deal could mean for international aid. Mm-hmm. And I think we should also be thinking about how that same philosophy could apply to the billions of dollars we spend on foreign aid that are often not going at all towards fighting poverty.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so good to hear somebody actually think and talk about the future because we don't get it much from our politicians. It's all today and in the present and maybe tomorrow and no further than that. Well, Lila Jana, the founder and CEO of Somasaurus and Luxme, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Where can people find out more about Luxme and all the little Samas?
So Somasaurus.org, Samaschool.org, and Luxme, LXMI.com.
Thanks, Lila. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Denver. Great to be here.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Through Grameen America's groundbreaking microfinance model, tens of thousands of low-income women in New York are getting the financial capital they need to build small businesses and climb out of poverty. Join the movement. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And And for this edition of Better Than Most, we will be visiting the New York offices of Ideas 42, an organization dedicated to using behavioral science for social good. We'll begin with their executive director, Josh Wright, and then hear from some of the other members of the team.
Who's most aware that they want and need feedback? It's the person receiving the feedback. So yes, we train the manager to give feedback, but equally we train and encourage people to ask for the feedback because that's critical. It's on their mind. They have the moment of action, as we talked about before. So it's very much within our culture to say, hey, can you give me feedback on this thing? And then the manager wants to give feedback. They don't have the moment of action in their mind. It creates the moment of action, and then feedback's given at a much higher rate.
But my part is awesome because it also reflects a diversity in experience and expertise. There is one person who's a talent manager, and then the chief innovation officer sits right next to me in the pod, and then there's a senior associate working on a vastly different domain sitting right up opposite me. So people working on vastly different things, bringing in vastly different experiences to the pod every day. So it's a lot of fun.
If there's one thing that I think really characterizes all of the people that work here, it's that we really geek out on the stuff that we do and kind of get obsessive and love to learn more. So this is one of the things that I learned really quickly here is that people here won't take things at face value. They'll read all of the papers and the bibliography for something and kind of tear apart methods and also go out and learn new stuff constantly. So there's a real culture of learning that underlies our nerdiness. And it's just great to be in that kind of intellectual atmosphere all the time where people are pushing their own knowledge, learning more, teaching each other. So love the spirit.
I think the other thing that I think of when I think of our corporate culture, though, is that we I feel that we're pretty scrappy. There's a lot of work to be done, and everyone really hops in and gets involved, whether it's helping on a project that you're technically not allocated to, or helping to just clean up the office, or helping to put on the giant behavioral summit that we just did. Everyone is really kind of all hands on deck, and you're not too senior or too junior to get involved with anything you want to be a part of.
Training was essentially a binder when I started, and now they've provided such a support system and a structure with the trainings. You start in cohorts, and you really feel like you're more of the community when you start out. So that's one big improvement that I've noticed. The degree to which they get all team members involved, so everyone gives presentations on whether it's our methodology, our core values, and it could be an associate giving these presentations or our executive director.
I think that that's something that we strive for all the time, really making sure that when we're thinking about our internal processes or when we're applying things to our work, that we're being very thoughtful about asking the right questions. Because if we don't, we're going to end up going down pathways that are not going to lead to the impact that we ultimately want. And so that's a really important guiding principle for us here.
Whereas I feel like at Ideas 42, whenever a project starts, there is a moment where where the team discusses what the project's going to be, what people are interested in developing into, what roles they see themselves in the future. And we have that space to develop our roles and to figure out what's exciting and interesting and new and challenging to us and who can support us in getting there. And we can really take that initiative and go there and develop into the professionals and people that we want to be and have the support system around us so that we don't crash and burn, but we're still challenged and we still find ourselves really growing towards something. I think it keeps us all engaged and excited because no one person, unless you want to keep doing the same thing or you feel like doing the same thing is a way to keep refining your skills, you don't have to be doing the same thing. And it means that teams are constantly in conversation about their roles, what they're learning, what's challenging to them, and you end up relying on your teammates a lot.
We celebrate on Twitter with hashtag behavioral Valentines, and these are Valentines that are written as if from a behavioral scientist. So people who are active on Twitter, Ideas 42, participate. We tweet from Ideas 42. But even more than that, it's actually the whole behavioral science community. They kind of get ingrained in your head because they rhyme. I think there was one that was something like chocolates and flowers are very nice, but nothing's better than a commitment device.
Something about Ideas 42 that no one would know unless they worked here is I think the extent to which our organization the extent to which our organization is like a mullet. We're very business in the front, but party in the back. I think by business in the front, I mean we do a lot of rigorous work, and a lot of our work follows intense methodologies. A lot of evaluation goes into the designs that we create, and even when we present a finished product, it's very professional, clean, and polished. But then when you go behind the scenes of what happened to create such high quality work, you see that it is actually a lot of fun. There's a lot of brainstorming, but design sessions that are happening, free thinking outside of the box, and we're doing it in a fun way, which I think does contribute to the high quality work that we have, but it's something that people wouldn't realize the extent to which we're a mullet.
The way that we go about doing that is by having a behaviorally informed hiring process that also builds in some equity lenses to the way that we think about hiring. So as everyone, I think, in the room can attest to, our hiring process is long and maybe painful at times, but it's designed in that way so that we can be sure that we're selecting the right folks. And, it's not 100% hit rate, but it's important to us that people invest in coming here. So it's a 4-stage process. Everything is rubric screened and oriented towards the competencies that we know are needed for people to succeed here, including people giving us a piece of work in miniature when they're asked to do a case study. So we make sure that people, to the best capacity that we can, come here equipped to do the work, including fitting into the culture.
Part of the reason that we do that is that we know that through the hiring process, certain human biases can creep in where we begin to evaluate people not on their ability or merit, but by other factors that may not matter to how well they actually do in the job. And rubric scoring during these steps in our process is one of the ways to actually mitigate those biases creeping in.
This is particularly how we deal with conflict. And to provide an anecdote, about 4 years ago in one of our retreats, it had surfaced that some junior team members wanted a better way to express issues and bring up problems to the senior team. And they spent a long time defining, all right, what exactly is the problem here? Then diagnosing what are the factors, behavioral or structural, behind this issue, talking about potential solutions, and then actually testing them out. And what they came up with was office hours. And they now send out every week this sign-up sheet for all of the senior team members. You can sign up to have these office hour sessions and just talk with the senior team.
That said, it's also really nice that we get things like a fitness reimbursement each month to take care of ourselves. So that's like for fitness classes or a gym membership or a bike or whatever you want to use that for. So I really like that balance of doing good for others and then taking care of our own health by the organization.
Something that I noticed during hiring, right after, before starting, but after getting an offer, was sort of salaries and the general sort of back and forth that happens, except that there wasn't a back and forth, which I really appreciated because I'm a philosophy nerd and I have like strong ideals about how we should not only be transparent, but also avoid biases in how we're remunerating people. Mm-hmm. And Ideas 42 has a published rubric that everybody can see about what everybody is paid depending on like their rank, and there is no leeway on that matter. These are set numbers.
So I would love it when we'd get into the test phase and then I could just sit and try to figure out how to run code or whatnot, but it really forced me, because for most of the projects one person is involved through all the stages, it forced me to kind of get out of my comfort zone and learn how to do qualitative interviews, how to speak with people, how to manage partner relationships, and it really, I think, set the stage for me to be more confident and better in my work and really see the different aspects involved in a project and not get siloed in just one skill set.
I think that our mission often is not to focus on the individuals within the teams, but to think really about the progress and the of the project itself. And so when the team succeeds, everybody does succeed, and we can all congratulate ourselves. But I also think, you know, the flip side of this is that in terms of our own personal development, we're often really seeking out criticism, not because we think that criticizing people is good inherently, but because in order for us to make those changes and learn, it's really important for us to be able to receive that kind of feedback. And I think that one of the other things that's great about this organization is that we are trying to engender a culture of psychological safety that enables that to occur in a fluid way, so that when criticism is provided, it's thought about as being a constructive piece of personal development as opposed to, you know, sniping or something.
This happens, I think, constantly through emails. When someone else has done something and I'm sharing it, I mention their name. It's not my work. And we always make sure that during calls when we're talking with partners or we're talking about developments, the person who owned that and who's responsible for it is the one who's going to talk about it and sort of get to experience that moment of other people being excited about the work you're doing or having more questions or wanting to know more, because I think that that's sort of where you get the most enjoyment out of your own work, but also the way that you can get recognized across the organization. And this happens in presentations too. We always have people present the work they've done, and we always mention the rest of our team.
I want to thank Mitra Salasel for arranging my visit, and to all those who participated in this piece, Leanna Johnson, Shriam Shridran, Raheen Conker, Anthony Barrows, Weihan Ung, Jackie Leftkowitz, Alex Blau, and Viviane Caetano. To hear this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of the participants in the offices, just come to denver-frederick.com. And we'll have a link there to my full interview with Josh Wright, the executive director of Ideas 42. And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be David Van Zandt, the president of the New School. So I hope you can join me for that. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.